The Steelworkers Union demands pensions for its members, paid for by the steel companies. What about this and other benefits in private Social Security agreements? Who should get them, and who should pay for them? Those are the questions. This is America United, a weekly NBC program where labor, business, and agriculture publicly discuss their agreements and their differences, united in the belief they should be discussed publicly and freely. Today's program is transcribed, and our host is the Chamber of Commerce of the United States, represented by Emerson P. Schmidt. Our other guests, Senator Paul Douglas, Democrat of Illinois, James B. Carey, Secretary-Treasurer of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and Lloyd Halverson of the National Grange. Our moderator is David Brinkley, NBC Washington commentator. Mr. Brinkley.
What are the issues in private supplementary Social Security programs? That is, what about pensions and other benefits paid for by employers? Today, we have in this country several labor management disputes and hundreds of thousands of workers in basic industries out on strike. The strike issues are a little unusual in that they do not involve wage increases as such. They involve, in part, a more or less new labor management issue, pensions and other benefits for workers. In the case of the steel strike, the union calls on the management to pay the cost of pensions and other benefits for its employees. The management has refused. So what we have here is a relatively new issue in labor management relations, the issue of security and sickness and old age for workers, and who's going to pay for it. It's a rather complex question and an interesting one that affects directly or indirectly almost everybody. So today we have moved America United to the Senate Radio Gallery in the United States Capitol for a discussion by four men thoroughly familiar with it. First, let's ask each of the four to tell us briefly how he feels about today's question. I'll begin with Senator Douglas.
I think the demand for private supplementary pensions has arisen because the public old age pension and old age insurance laws give very inadequate sums to aged people. For example, men who have been employed in private industry are only entitled to about $26 a month on the average under the federal Social Security law. And with the additions for a wife, the total for man and wife is only brought to $40 a month. This was inadequate in 1935. With the 70% increase in the cost of living which has occurred since then, it is still more inadequate now. And it is this inadequacy of the public system, which in my judgment has forced the unions to demand a larger amount of private insurance.
Thank you. And now Dr. Schmidt of the Chamber of Commerce of the United States.
I agree very strongly with Senator Douglas, and I'd like to hear from him as to why Congress has been so tardy in correcting at least certain of the obvious inequities. Business, by and large, has favored not only the expansion of the coverage, but also an increase in benefit levels. I personally have testified before numerous congressional committees, and we've had other persons testifying in behalf of improved coverage and improved benefit formulae, and yet nothing has been done by the 79th Congress, the 80th Congress, and the 81st Congress. And I think it is regrettable that the correction has not been made in the light of the rise in the cost of living.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Halverson of the National Grange.
Well, we of the National Grange, too, have favored the extension of Social Security to farm people. Now, in regard to these private plans, I think that from the standpoint of farmers, the main issue, as I see it, is whether or not the cost of private supplementary Social Security programs for the privileged groups is passed on to the farmers and others who do not have benefits of any kind. And I am inclined to believe that the cost is passed on to the general public, and then the question immediately arises as to whether or not this is fair and equitable for just a few to have these benefits.
Thank you. Now, Mr. Carey of the Congress of Industrial Organizations.
The American people pay the managers of industry extremely well for their services. In addition, they guarantee them full employment at an annual wage with full protection during unemployment caused by sickness or accident. They also assure the members of the management group of industry extremely generous pensions when they retire. The real issue and regarding supplementary social security programs, as why does the United States Chamber of Commerce oppose these programs for the production workers that are enjoyed by the members of management? I can't agree that Dr. Smith's organization, the Chamber of Commerce, has been vigorous in trying to improve the benefits of government Social Security. In fact, the Chamber of Commerce is against extending the benefits. They were against Social Security being enacted by government in the first instance, as they were against minimum wage, health insurance, aid to education, public housing, rent control, TVA, and the recent steam plant controversy. They're opposed to the strengthening of the Labor Department. In fact, they're opposed to all the things that are so necessary and essential to the security of working people.
Well, Mr. Carey,
Dr. Smith,
it's a little unfortunate that you will challenge what I say. I'd be very glad to cite the Senate hearings and the House hearings in which the exact contrary is the case. And I think we ought to have a fact-finding board here to see whether what you say is really correct. It's obviously quite incorrect.
Well, Dr. Smith, can I point this up to you? When we're discussing improving Social Security benefits in Congress, American industry, by and large, especially as represented by the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers, contends that the government is getting too large, that these Social Security items should be dealt with in collective bargaining. And now that they're being dealt with in steel and auto and the other industries, you come as a late champion of Social Security programs by government.
No, you're wrong, unfortunately, Mr. Carey.
Well, shall we for a moment refer that one to a fact-finding board? And there's a question here I'd like to ask about the issue of pensions, whether they're paid for by the union or by the company or by both. How much of a new idea is this? Is this pretty common practice in some industries already, or is it a radical departure from past practice, or what is it? How many pensions of that kind are being paid now? Does anybody know?
I don't suppose anybody has complete figures, but it's... I think there are about 8,000 or 10,000 companies, substantially sized companies, that qualify under the Treasury provisions for deducting the cost of these pensions as an expense of business. And then there are, of course, hundreds, probably thousands, of untrusted schemes of this kind, but we don't know just how many.
Well, Dr. Smith, aren't they primarily designed to protect the interests of the executives of corporations?
Do we have 8 million executives in this country of corporations, or do you think that some of those 8 million might be...
I'm talking now about the large percentage of the 8 million, the comparison between whether they're designed to protect the members of management or are they designed to protect the production workers?
Go ahead, Senator
Douglas. It seems to me that one of the difficulties with private plans in the past has been this, that of necessity they have restricted pensions to those who have been employed for a period of from 25 to 30 years in the individual company and have reached the age of 65. And I do not question the necessity of an individual company imposing such restrictions. But this means that only a small percentage of the workers can qualify for benefits because there are only relatively few workers who are employed continuously for as long as 25 or 30 years when they reach the age of retirement. Therefore, it seems to me much better if we could enlarge our public system of old age care so that workers could be mobile and be free to move from company to company without losing the equities and rights which have been built up for them. Now, this is not to say anything against the drive of unions for private pensions, because I think that has been brought about, as I have said, by the fact that our public laws are grossly inadequate.
Years ago, Justice Brandeis once called these private industrial pension plans the new industrial peonage. And I wonder, Senator, if there isn't a little danger in that same thing developing when you have unions administering these plans. Are the union... workers likely to become beholden to the union leaders? Are they likely to become peons or slaves or prisoners of labor leaders? Do you see any possible danger there at all?
Dr. Smith, do I understand you to say that if the workers have these pension plans, they become peons? Let me say to you quite frankly that if that's true of the workers, why is it not true of yourself and the others that represent the managerial group of the United States?
Well, I'd like to know what the senator thinks of Brandeis's characterization some 30 years ago. How does that apply? Or is this a new epoch we're living in?
Senator Douglas?
Well, I prefer a public system because, as I've said, it makes possible a greater mobility of movement on the part of the worker and does not tie the worker to an individual company. But I must say that I listened with a great deal of interest to your statement that you had always been for an extension of the federal old age insurance plan. I'm not going to question your word, but I will say this, that the majority of employers have not. And it has been employer opposition, which we have primarily encountered in Congress, which has prevented the extension of the system.
I don't think that's correct, Senator. Now, why is it that H.R. 6000, which is the bill before the House Ways and Means Committee and currently before the House, why is it that these firm group that Mr. Halverson represents are being again excluded and other groups are being excluded?
Well, certainly
domestic servants are being excluded.
Now, you understand that the labor movement is for extended coverage.
That's right.
Minimum
so
wage
are we.
Now, pardon me, sir. I think the senator can testify as to the impressions he gets from the United States Chamber of Commerce documents and the presentation of their testimony. It's news to me, and believe me, it's news to me, that you or the organization you represent favor extension of Social Security coverage over groups of workers in this country.
Or limitation of benefits.
That's correct.
That is absolutely astounding to me, Jim, as much as you're concerned with this program, that you don't know that
Let the listeners judge as to whether or not they have reason to believe that the Chamber of Commerce has been opposed to extended coverage of minimum wage legislation, of public housing development.
We're not talking about public
housing.
We're talking about
this. It's part of the security of the people of this country.
If you want to broaden it.
Yes, we're talking about the security derived by farmers from the extension of public power.
We're talking about private supplementary Social Security programs.
And all of these things are necessary because of the opposition of the Chamber of Commerce to the government doing it. So since the government has been unable to do it because of the opposition of the employers, then, of course, private industry is required to do it by the operation of the collective bargaining process.
I'd like to go back to this matter of whether or not the fact that the management of business gets pensions, whether or not that is an excuse for broadening it out to workers. Probably we ought to cut it out in the first case for management and let them also get most of their benefits from a public like Social Security.
Yes,
in their private savings. I think that is something, too, that we have to consider.
What would you say to that, Dr. Schmidt?
Well, I think they're... I don't want to defend pensions for management and not for workers. I think that's wrong.
That's what I thought you were going to bring up.
But you must remember this, that in part, the growth of these pensions was a deliberate attempt on the part of management to raise wages during the war when wages were frozen. Management had a tough time recruiting labor. This was one way to give an improved wage without coming under the control of the War Labor Board. Second, part of the pension costs of managerial talent is really a wage cost. And in order to recruit top-ranking management, instead of giving it all in wages or salaries, you give it partly in pension costs. Now, any businessman will tell you that that is the case. Now, if a businessman has to recruit pattern makers or machinists, and if he has to give them a pension, I see no personal objection whatsoever. If he wants to pay that worker, and if the worker wants to accept part of his pay in the form of Social Security benefits, supplementary.
Isn't that, as a matter of fact, what is happening in many cases, that workers forego wage increases, which they otherwise would obtain...
Especially this year.
...in return for health benefits and old age benefits, that they really have made the sacrifices themselves.
And
except
may I
for the,
say this, Dr.
except for the
Smith,
point that Mr. Halverson brings
yeah,
up, I see no objection to it.
Why don't you
it
answer Mr.
Iniquity.
Halverson's question, though? Now, you know that these managerial pensions have been operating down through the years. They've been operating in General Electric and Westinghouse, United States Steel, and these corporations long before the First World War, not just the Second. And you know that they're self-imposed. They're voted for the management by the members of management. They decide to give themselves pensions. They decide to give themselves wage adjustments in order to offset the cost of those pensions. And as he pointed out, they have been passing them on to the consumer.
I think there's a lot of
stockholders have to generally vote on those.
The stockholders are normally passive, Mr. Schmidt.
Well, they are.
All right.
Management controls the stockholders' meeting.
As Mr. Halverson has stated, if they're good for the members of management, why aren't they good for the workers?
I've never argued that they're not good for the workers, Jim.
Well, let's see. Is the Chamber of Commerce in favor
of the pension program requested by Steele, recommended by the fact-finding report.
We haven't taken any position on that, but I testified before the Steele board.
Is there any case when you did take a position in favor of a pension for workers?
I certainly did. In fact,
in what private industry, in what company?
I testified before the Steele Industry Board, Mr. Carey, and I definitely said if the steel workers prefer to take part of their wages in the form of Social Security or other deferred income, that, it seems to us, that's the Chamber of Commerce, should be their privilege.
Now, do these
we
steel companies
the steel
belong
management.
To the Chamber of Commerce?
Yes, they do.
And do you,
and
you think you should exercise some influence?
I said we believe that the steel management will be open-minded to reasonable requests of this nature. Now, Mr. Carey, you're simply misreporting our position. I don't know why you do this. Furthermore, the steel industry has already accepted the 10 cents an hour, but they think that you ought to go further and have the workers contribute something so that they will have a legitimate interest in the administration, and there will be some degree of restraint.
Contribute something, Mr. Smith.
Yes.
Don't you understand that these pensions are paid for out of the joint effort of management and labor?
That's right.
They
capital.
Contribute their labor. They
That's
contribute
right.
their time and their skills and their energy.
That's right.
They're the ones that pay for the pensions that the managers get. Why shouldn't they get the same kind of pensions? Perhaps not in as, generous in terms of amounts, but they certainly should get at least the same principles applied to them that produce the funds that pay for these things.
I see.
Now, I ask this question, Dr. Smith. If it's good for management, if it's good for management to protect in the form of reserves their machines and to have reserves for rehabilitation of their plants, how about the human factors involved in this?
I'd be glad to answer that, but again, let me make it very clear that except for the point that Mr. Halverson raised, that is the inequities of these private schemes, that is, they won't get to farmers, they won't get to a lot of other workers, I see no objection whatsoever for what you're driving at. I'm in favor of it. Now, on this question of machines, I thought we've just struggled since 1914 to get rid of the idea that labor is a commodity. It's not a machine. It's not a commodity. They're free agents. Now, if the workers were slaves of the employer, I would agree 100% that the employer had a full responsibility to take care of them in their old age.
But labor should be a commodity, but I say that they should be treated at least as well as a machine.
I think they ought to be treated better than a machine.
All right, then let's talk about should labor, the productive labor, get the same conditions that exist with members of management. That's the point I ask.
I certainly have no objection to that.
I think that it looks as though there would be a happy harmony of interests when the Social Security bill comes up in Congress. Here's Dr. Smith pledging his support to an extension of coverage and liberalization of benefits, and I presume he speaks for the Chamber of Commerce. I only hope that there will be a grand procession of former sinners hitting the sawdust trail and coming forward for better and more generalized protection.
Mr. Brinkley, I'd like to go back to something here that seems to me to be quite important. It seems as if the Chamber of Commerce has agreed that it'd be all right for the steelworkers to get part of their increase in wages in the form of Social Security benefits. And the strike, as I understand it now, is held up by the fact that Steele says the workers should contribute to something, too. Well, Mr. Carey, wouldn't it be a settlement of the strike if the steel companies agreed to pay 5% of that 10% to the workers who would in turn contribute it towards this pension plan?
Mr. Halverson, we're interested in getting pensions that grow out of the joint effort of management and labor, not to be passed on to the consumer in the form of higher prices. We're asking the steel companies to share their exorbitant profits with the people that produced those profits. We're saying to them, without raising prices, let's see if you can't reduce prices, at the same time pay better wages, but even more important than that, provide the kind of security you already provide for the members of management, and take that out of the profits. Now, that's where it should be taken. It's the profit proposition.
That's where we hope it would come.
Now, I ask this question. Don't you know that the profits in the steel industry are higher now in the last few years than they've ever been?
Yes,
they're
I am.
They're shameful today, and they should be shared with all the people in a form of reduced prices, increased benefits for the workers, and a continuation of these very elaborate salaries and pension plans for these members of management.
Well, here's the question I was asking you, whether or not the steel workers would be willing to take a 5% wage increase and contribute, turn around and contribute that towards this Social Security fund.
Well, the issue here is to whether or not the pension should be taken out of profits as against being taken out of wages in the form of a wage reduction.
Well, if wages are increased, it amounts to the same thing.
I ask this? Suppose you're familiar with the President's fact-finding report.
That's right.
That report specifically states, we believe the foregoing recommendations constitute a fair and equitable settlement of the steel dispute. Now, it either is correct in that quotation or it's not correct. If it's a fair and equitable settlement of the steel dispute, why do these people of the steel industry who give themselves these pensions and everything that is asked for the workers, only in larger amounts, why do they say we stand on principle and say no? That the workers must take a wage cut in order to contribute to these pension programs.
No, I wasn't suggesting a wage cut. I was suggesting he get a 5% wage increase and then would turn around and contribute that 5% wage increase towards this Social Security Fund. Seems to me that then you would have a contributory plan, you'd have established a principle, and you could end the strike.
May well, I a question in here? It's this. There are defects in contributory systems for individual firms which do not exist in the general public system, which is, of course, based on contributions. In the public system, both sides contribute equal amounts, at present 1% each. That, in my judgment, should be raised to at least 2% and possibly 2.5%. But under the public system, you can move from plant to plant and take your equities with you, so to speak. But in a private firm, if the workers have made contributions during the time that they are employed, when they leave, they will naturally have a claim, not on the employer's contributions, perhaps, but on the contributions which they themselves have made. And you will therefore need an elaborate system of bookkeeping to determine what the withdrawal equity rights are of each and every individual workman. You therefore involve yourself in a very complicated administrative problem when you have contributory systems set up on the individual plant or on the individual company basis.
That's one of the primary reasons, Senator, why we have persistently argued that even the railroad workers should be covered under the general Social Security scheme. The government workers should likewise. And then if the railroads and the government wants to create supplementary schemes, that should be their privilege, in the case of private enterprise.
We have
argued that over and over again before the Finance Committee and the House Ways and Means Committee.
Dr. Smith, I understood you a little earlier to say that they introduced these pension plans in order to attract workers, members of management, and also...
Primarily management.
And isn't it true that through the operation of these private plans, in addition to the government plans that should be extended and improved, that will help maintain a continuity of employment, that the workers will remain with a particular company, not in the form of slavery as you indicated.
Well, that's what Brandeis's notion, that it was slavery.
It might have been before, in Brandeis' time, before we had the collective bargaining arrangements we have today. We have labor movements today that can adequately protect the workers from peonage and slavery. I quite frankly think they will do a better job of protecting the workers against
those. Well, we haven't any evidence on that,
well,
Mr. Perry.
I was going to say a better job than you will do or your Chamber of Commerce.
Well, I don't know about that. Well, I don't know why you're so high-minded and we're so low-minded.
No, you're very high-minded when it comes to protecting the interest of the members of the Chamber of Commerce.
We don't think there is a distinction between the interests of the American people and the Chamber of Commerce and its members.
Well, there is.
There is a community of interest, a basic, fundamental community of interest. And why you have to persist in this Marxian class struggle idea, I don't know why.
Oh, you're the class struggle man. You want these conditions to apply just to a small segment of American...
I have denied that over and over again,
Mr. Carey.
I'm
talking now about in your
practice.
I do. I sit when you testify before Congress. I agree with Senator Douglas that the impression I get from your testimony is...
You didn't say that.
No, I said the impression that I get from employers as a whole, that the employing groups as a whole... have been opposed to this, not necessarily
Mr.
Smith.
That isn't correct, Senator, because we represent the bulk of the American employers, I suppose.
Well, you may represent the better side.
No, I don't think so. I think the little fellows and the big ones.
They represent the best, but the best is none too good when it comes to this kind of social legislation. You have not had a record of being aggressive in trying to get Social Security benefits improved in the
Congress. But Mr. Perry, Mr. Smith is saying that now they will join us. And
not
I'm
only
always,
now, Senator.
I'm not so much interested in what has happened in the past as what's happened and is going to happen in the future. And I'm delighted, as I've said before, that Mr. Smith is going to join us, and I hope the Chamber of Commerce also, in getting extended coverage and in getting benefits liberalized. They'll be of tremendous help in getting this legislation through.
But
this
why
is the
isn't
most
your
cheering
Senate?
Comment that I've heard for a long time.
But I want to know, Senator, why is the Senate so tardy? Now, the House apparently is going to do something, but why is the Senate not doing this?
We'll be along.
1949.
I don't happen to be on the Finance Committee, which handles this legislation in the Senate, but you can be sure that the same group which has been struggling to repeal the Taft-Hartley law to get a decent minimum wage will be in there slugging for liberalized and extended Social Security, and we'll be delighted to have the Chamber of Commerce by our side.
You will have, and you have
You don't
had.
Mind if I indicate a little note of pessimism here? Because if it's just a continuation of their program, we won't get this united support that we need in order to enact legislation.
Well, you're just wrong, Jim.
Pardon?
You're just wrong.
Well, quite frankly, I'd like to see you practice a little bit of what you profess to preach.
We have had witnesses before all these committees in every single hearing, I think, ever since I'm at the Chamber.
Well, I'm glad we're talking now for the record and that this is being broadcast, because if the editorial writers understand that the Chamber of Commerce is for these programs...
I think they do, but you don't seem to.
Well, quite frankly, I read them. And, of course, the unions don't advertise very much in the newspapers, and we can't influence them very much. But you fellows advertise a great deal, and your words, Dr. Smith, will be, I think, enlightening to the newspapers of this country. That you're in favor of extending Social Security to cover agricultural groups. You're in favor of extending Social Security to have broader coverage.
Even self-employed, we're for.
Fine.
And domestic service,
and to
which they're not
the
going to cover on the Hill.
Now, isn't it true that other legislation likewise should be broadened in order to include those groups, like minimum wage legislation?
Include the farm groups?
Oh, sure. Farm workers, the people that work for farmers should be covered by, all workers should be covered by minimum wage legislation. But now,
no, I can't.
Mr. Halverson has something to say about it.
I agree with that. For one thing, we feel that if we do have minimum wage legislation, there should be provisions for flexibility in that. We know that prices do change, go up and down, and certainly wages should go up and down in harmony with prices, because if they don't, we really get our economy in bad shape.
Mr. Halverson, can I ask you if the workers should pay the risks of doing business, or do you think it is the bondholders, the stockholders, that should pay the risk of doing business?
I think workers would be much better off if they took a flexible wage rather than a high wage, with resulting unemployment for a great many of them.
Now, if they're going to take the risk, should not they share in the profits?
I'm sorry we don't have time for an answer to that question, but our time is all gone. We've had some interesting explorations today of some political byways, and we hope our listeners, having heard these varying views, will decide for themselves who should get these benefits and who should pay for them. To summarize, Senator Douglas thinks labor's demands for pensions have come because public pension laws are inadequate and that they should be improved. Dr. Schmidt of the Chamber of Commerce agrees with that, but points out Congress has not acted. Mr. Halverson of the Grange wonders if privately paid benefits to workers won't be passed on in the form of higher prices to consumers who will get no benefit. And Mr. Carey of the CIO points out industry's management is paid well and is given generous pensions and thinks the same benefits should be available to workers. He says he doubts the Chamber has very vigorously worked for improved public pension laws. We have originated today from the radio gallery in the United States Capitol, and we should point out those background noises you hear are the workmen who are renovating this side of the Capitol. Our thanks to all four of you. Here is our announcer.
This has been America United, with another discussion by spokesmen for labor, business, and agriculture of a topic of public interest. You can get a free copy of today's unrehearsed discussion by writing to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Washington 6, D.C. Speaking today were Senator Paul Douglas, James B. Carey, Lloyd Halverson of the National Grange, and Emerson P. Schmidt, speaking for our host, the Chamber of Commerce of the United States. Our moderator was David Brinkley. This program was transcribed and brought to you by the NBC Network and its independent affiliated stations.